off, Jamie replied. The cartographer is a strange creature who keeps his own counsel. Now, this third symbol is how the child located you. Us, he continued. Pi. It is the symbol of the caretaker Principia. As I understand it, only one of the caretakers, as its intended recipients, should be able to erase this mark and replace it with another. That should do the trick.
Doesn't that still leave us with a problem? Wondered Charles. The way Laura Glue explained how the compass rose works, it glows as you come into proximity of the person being sought. How will that help us?
It works that way if you want it to, Jamie explained. But Bert explained it to me once. In principle, it functions like these radios everyone is using nowadays. It can be tuned to receive, as it was used in locating us, or it can be adjusted to broadcast, as it will do once we've added a new symbol. Then we'll just have to wait and see if someone comes.
But what if no one is listening? Asked Jack. What if no one comes?
Then your job becomes a lot easier, doesn't it? Jamie retorted. But don't worry. Someone is always listening. And someone always comes.
So, said Jamie, who wants to do it?
I should, John replied gravely. I'm the caretaker Principia. It's my responsibility.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Charles said, grabbing the rose.
He ran his thumb back and forth over the symbol, and in a trice it had been completely erased.
Sometimes you shouldn't stand on ceremony. You should just do what needs doing and move on.
Yes, said John. Well done, Charles. So, he continued, turning again to Jamie, whom should we summon?
In a crisis, the only man I'd want at my side would be Nemo, Jamie stated.
His mark is Persian, but I've seen it used, and I'm certain it'll work.
What? What is it?
At the mention, again, of Nemo's name, all three of the companions started visibly, then seemed unwilling to meet Jamie's eyes.
Regarding Nemo, John began.
No, said Jack. It's for me to say. He folded his arms and drew a sharp breath. Nemo won't be coming, he said at length. Nemo is dead. He was killed in battle.
Jamie couldn't conceal his dismay.
But that can't be. Nemo is unbeatable in a conflict, whether on land or at sea. Not only is he one of the best strategists who ever lived, but he's charmed. He's the seventh son of the seventh son of Sinbad himself. No, he concluded, shaking his head. You must be mistaken.
I'm not, Jack insisted, his voice shaking with emotion. I saw him die. And what's more, it was my fault. So please, say no more of it. But trust my word. If summoned, Nemo will not come.
Jamie regarded Jack, his expression inscrutable.
That's very interesting, Jack. Very interesting indeed. I can see the event had quite an effect on you.
The event, as you call it, was one of the worst experiences of my life, said Jack. How do you think it makes me feel to know that choices I made led to someone's death?
Were they good choices or bad choices? Asked Jamie.
What kind of question is that? Countered Jack. How can they have been anything but bad choices?
Paddy trusted me and he died.
Paddy, John said.
You mean Nemo, don't you?
Well, yes, said Jack. I meant to say Nemo.
Warney mentioned that you'd had a friend die in the war, put in Charles, but he told us you were nowhere near the battle and had nothing to do with it.
That doesn't matter, Jack said. I promised Paddy's mother that I'd look after him, and I let him get killed, just as I did Nemo.
It isn't the same, argued John.
Sure it is, said Jack. They both died because of choices I made. If I had done things differently before that conflict at the Western Front, gone a day earlier or a day later, anything, if I had done anything differently, Paddy would still be alive. And I've had to see his mother's face every day since the war, loving me for trying, loving me for taking his place in caring for her, always, always knowing that I failed and let him die.
Everyone makes choices, said Jamie.
and we have to live with those choices. Did Avon ever tell you what went on between us?
No, said Charles, but we inferred a great deal from the number of opportunities she took to curse you.
Hey, Jamie chuckled sadly. I can't say I blame her. At one time, not really all that long ago, we were very much in love, she and I. Not to give offence, said John, but aren't you considerably older than Avon? Jamie squinted at him. There are more mysteries in the archipelago than you yet know, young John, he responded. Avon is not as young as she appears to be, and at that time I did not appear anywhere near as old as I was. But suffice it to say, she was the principal reason I agreed to become a caretaker.
I understand that, Jack said.
I think you do, said Jamie. But she was not the reason I left.
The widow, offered Charles, the woman here in London with the children, Avon mentioned her, and not much more favourably than she did you, I'm afraid.
Jamie shook his head. She never understood. There were responsibilities in the archipelago for which I was not prepared, and there were opportunities for responsibility here that I hoped to embrace. And so I did.
And you've been happy ever since, I suppose? Asked Charles.
Would that it were so, said Jamie. All I wanted to do was be a father, a mentor, a brother to those five boys, to protect them from the evils of the world. And I didn't think I could do that from an archipelago of islands at the edges of existence. I thought I could do it if I were right here with them. But I was wrong.
He lowered his head and closed his eyes.
You lost your friend Paddy in the war? He asked Jack, looking up.
Yes.
And you too lost someone? He said to John, who nodded. And you? To Charles, who also indicated a loss.
You see, Jamie said with a tremor in his voice, I also lost someone in that war. One of my boys. And I lost another after the war, to a drowning that may have even been by his own hand. So what good has it done that I chose to leave my role as caretaker if I could not protect those whom I loved, even from themselves?
He banged a fist against the mantel, startling the dog. At least you three jumped headlong into it and took the battle to one of the prime causes, the Winter King himself. Perhaps if I had done that, if I had stayed, the war might have ended sooner, and I might still have my George. So who am I to judge good choices from bad? But, he finished, turning again to Jack, I know that you should not carry the guilt that you do for Nemo's death. Events on that day transpired exactly as they needed to.
How can you say that? Said Jack, incredulous.
Because I know Nemo was very close to Jules Verne, answered Jamie, and Jules knew many things that he never shared with any of us. But I know one thing he passed on to Nemo, that I am happy to share with you. Nemo knew the exact hour and means of his death, and, knowing this, he had the ability to change events if he so chose. He didn't, and thus the responsibility for his death was not yours, young Jack.
Indeed, it never was. Several stiff drinks were poured, and the four men sat in silence as they absorbed what had been said. Laura Glue stirred, and Jamie rose to cover her with a blanket.
So, John said finally, the compass rose.
Yes, said Jack, I'd nearly forgotten.
John looked at Jamie. What symbol should we use, since Nemo's is not likely to do us any good? In response, Jamie took a book from one of his shelves and thumbed through to a Greek alphabet. He quickly scanned the letters, then pointed to one.
This one, he declared, tapping his finger.
It's the only one I can really be certain of.
Omega, noted John. The ending.
Yes, Jamie said without turning around. That's Bert's little joke.
This will summon Bert, John said in surprise.
That would be delightful. I'd love to see him again.
As would I, said Jamie. He was always a bit more well-disposed toward my choices than his daughter was. But then, as a parent, I think he would be. Do any of you have children, if you don't mind my asking?
Jack looked a little uncomfortable at the question, but he didn't want to seem rude, not after the personal information Jamie had shared, and especially after the remark about Nemo. "Not thus far," he admitted, "but the future is long."
"I have one," said Charles, "a son, Michael."
"Three for me," said John. "My eldest, John, is 9, Michael is 2, and then young Christopher." Jamie stared at them with a forced smile, then choked back a sob and turned away. "Michael was the name of my boy who drowned," he said in a small voice. "So, let's get this job done, and see to it that no more Michaels become lost boys, eh?" Charles handed the rose to John, who quickly inscribed the mark Jamie had indicated on the parchment. "Now what?"
"Now," said Jamie, wiping at his eyes with a handkerchief. "We wait and see."
Chapter 4. A Dragon Restored. As the evening deepened into night, the four men busied themselves with small talk and took the opportunity to get to know one another a bit more. They were, after all, members of a very exclusive club, and John, Jack, and Charles found it very liberating to have someone else with whom to discuss the archipelago. With most others, most recently Jack's brother Warney, they had to guard their words carefully. But with Jamie, they were able to broach practically any topic. For his part, Jamie was mostly interested in their academic careers. He had spent enough of his life as a novelist and playwright that academia was fascinating to him.
"You really worked on the Oxford English Dictionary?" Jamie remarked to John. "Extraordinary."
"I was only there for about a year," John admitted. "The problem was, having been trained to read the Geographica, I had a better-than-average knack for going right to the root definitions of words, and they started to get suspicious."
"Oh, that's rich," Charles said, chortling. "You were actually too qualified for the job. If they'd kept you on, they might be finished by now."
"Craigie's close enough, I think," said John. "But messing about in the scriptorium with all those little notes crammed into cubbyholes, not for me, I'm afraid."
"One of the researchers on the OED was briefly considered as a caretaker back before Bert's time," said Jamie. "Murray. His impediment was that while he was a stellar researcher, he lacked imagination, just didn't have the spark. Affable enough, but just not cut out for the job."
"Lucky bastard,"
murmured Charles.
"What was that?"
John said.
"Who's for a bite?"
said Charles.
"I'm getting a bit peckish."
"As am I," Jamie agreed. "Charles, why don't you give me a hand, and we'll see if we can assemble some sandwiches to keep up our vigor."
As the two went down the hallway to the kitchen, Laura Glue stretched and yawned.
"Hey,"
she exclaimed, patting herself.
"Where's my flower?"
"Over here on the desk," said Jack.
"You changed it,"
she said appraisingly.
"But I like it. It looks like a circle with feet."
"Indeed it does," concurred Jack, noting that since they'd erased the pi symbol and adding the omega, the glowing had ceased. "But I don't know if it made it prettier to look at." Jamie and Charles returned with a silver tray laden with ham, cheese, and thick cuts of dark rye bread.
"Sorry there's no milder bread in the house," said Jamie.
"You can take the boy out of Scotland, but you can't make him give up his rye."
"Not a problem, I assure you," John said as he started slathering a piece of bread with a grainy mustard. "In fact, I think I prefer—" He stopped speaking when he realized that none of the others were listening. Instead, they were all looking at Laura Glue, who was still holding the compass rose. It was faint and indistinct, but the parchment flower had begun to glow.
"Well,"
Jamie said wryly, rubbing his dog's head,
"I think we may be in for more company."
"Do we need to be down by the river?"
asked Charles.
"If Bert is coming, won't he be piloting the White Dragon?"
"Or one of the other ships," Jack agreed. "Perhaps we should be waiting for him there." "It's a pleasant night out," said John. "There's no storm, there's been no murder, no one is chasing us. We have a comfortable study to relax in, a delicious pile of food in front of us, and for company, James Barry, with whom we can also talk about the Geographica and the Archipelago. And you seriously want me to consider leaving all this to go tromping alongside the Thames in the middle of the night, just in case it'll be easier for Bert to find us? I don't think so. And with that, he plopped down on one of the chairs and began to happily devour a huge ham sandwich.
See?
Charles said to Jamie. That's why he's the caretaker principia. After having consumed three sandwiches of her own, Laura Glue declared herself to be the caretaker of the Compass Rose. Carefully monitoring it for any change, she nestled back into the haunches of the huge, still-sleeping St. Bernard, Aramis.
His predecessors were Porthos and Athos, said Jamie. If I myself make it to a D'Artagnan, I'll be very contented.
There's something I've been meaning to ask you, said Jack, as he licked mustard off his fingers. When we found Laura Glue, she told us that she'd been sent to find you specifically, not just because you were the caretaker, but also because you were her grandfather's greatest enemy. And then, in the park, you said something about an adventure with your best friend, whom she said later became my enemy, and you've surmised they were the same person.
Well done, Jack.
Oddly enough, the reasons we became enemies have a lot to do with Avon as well. Although, I must point out a very important distinction between myself and the girl's grandfather. Just because he no longer regards himself as my friend does not necessarily mean I am no longer his. Before Jamie could elaborate, a newspaper struck the shutters, which clattered loudly against the windows of the library.
"Mmm," said Jamie. "The window shifted. I wonder what that means."
"Why?" asked John.
"It's March," Charles explained. "The wind never blows in from the west this time of year."
Wordlessly, the four men looked at one another, each of them thinking the same thing.
"Look,"
a voice said, soft with wonder. It was Laura Glue, who, unspeaking, woke the dog and was being given an involuntary bath by Aramis's massive tongue.
"Look at my flower."
There on the desk, the compass rose had begun to shine as if it were on fire, the symbols marked upon it swirling with an eldritch glow. Suddenly, a shadow passed over the windows, momentarily blocking the light from the waxing moon above. Puzzled, Jamie jumped to his feet, as did John.
"Was that a dragon, perhaps?"
asked Charles.
"Too slow," said Jamie.
"Maybe it..."
A loud knocking from one of the upper floors interrupted him.
"I think you have a visitor, Jamie,"
said Laura Glue sleepily. In an instant, all four caretakers were running to the hall and up the stairs. Jamie led the way to the fourth floor rooms, all of which had been tastefully appointed as bedrooms, save for the last. "I don't suppose this is the nursery?" Jack asked with a grin.
"Ha!" Jamie said over his shoulder. "Funny scholar you are. No, this is just a storage room. All I keep in here is an old, wardrobe, full of my mother's furs."
He flung the door wide, and together they entered the room. It was reasonably bare, save for the aforementioned wardrobe to the left, and an old pram on the right. Directly across from the door stood a double bay window, deep and uncurtained, so they could clearly see the silhouette of the figure hanging from a rope ladder, who was rapping on the sill. The strange visitor was short, stoutish, and most tellingly, had a tattered, tall, pointy hat perched precariously on his head. He knocked again, then called to them through the glass.
"Will someone please let me in? I've flown here all the way from the archipelago, and my arms are very tired."
Charles raised an eyebrow and grinned as they all rushed to the window.
"No question now. That's our man Bert, right enough. Someone give me a hand inside, will you?"
Bert cried as he clutched at the window with one hand and clung to the ladder with the other.
"Else I'll end up a handsome stain on the cobblestones."
"Bert, I'm so pleased to see you," said John as he reached out to grasp his mentor's hands.
"But what the devil are you flying? Is it an airplane of some sort?"
"Better," Bert said with a gleam in his eye. "It's an old friend, all dressed up to go a-visiting."
The friends all leaned out the open windows
and looked up at a sight both amazing and familiar. It was an airship, part blimp and part airplane. There was an air-filled balloon above, an elaborate carriage that had been fitted with propellers. But what was most startling was the carriage itself, which bore a carved masthead. It was the Indigo Dragon. Jack let out a whoop, and Charles started clapping Bert on the back so vigorously he nearly lost his hat. Once they had him safely inside and had anchored the ladder securely around the heavy wardrobe, each of the companions embraced Bert joyfully, and even Jamie gave him a warm, two-handed handshake.
"Old sock, good on you! Good on you, I say!"
Charles exclaimed happily.
"When you said you were hoping to repair her, I never expected anything as grand as this. Well done, Bert!" "In truth, it was more the craftsman back on Parallon who did it," said Bert. "Auto Mars was able to salvage the dragon itself, but the ship was a loss. Jules had had plans for an airship that Nemo had always wanted to,
He paused, looking hesitatingly at Jamie.
"It's all right, old chap," Jamie said. "They told me everything. In fact, we've had quite the opportunity to get acquainted, your young caretakers and I."
"But how did you get here so quickly?" John asked.
"It hasn't been more than a couple of hours since we summoned you."
"Quickly?" exclaimed Bert. "I'm only sorry it took so long. I was already on the edge of the frontier, on my way to Oxford, to consult with John about a crisis in the archipelago, when the sextant aboard the Indigo Dragon began to point toward London. That's when I realized someone had used a compass rose. But I scarcely expected to find you at Jamie's house."
"That's a story in and of itself," said John. "Let's go downstairs. There's someone you ought to meet." Laura Glue was rolling around on the floor with Aramis when the group came downstairs. Introductions were made, and when she shook hands with Bert, her eyes became the size of saucers.
"The Far Traveller? For really and truly?" she exclaimed. "No one will believe I actually met you."
"Really?" said Bert, flattered. "And why is that, my dear?"
"Because whenever you've been mentioned, my grandfather shakes his head and says your wick isn't lit. But you don't look anything like a candle at all."
John and Jamie let out a burst of laughter, and even Jack chuckled. Charles just smiled grimly and patted Bert on the back.
"Look at it this way. At least you didn't have to share the back seat of a car with her all day."
"All day?" said John. "It only took us a few hours to get to London."
"That's what it seemed like to you, maybe,"
Charles shot back.
"She'd come from the archipelago seeking me," said Jamie. "Her grandfather sent her, apparently."
They quickly told Bert what had taken place during the day, including Laura Glue's mysterious message, and his features grew very dark.
"That's troubling news indeed," Bert mused. "I'm as clueless as Jamie about the message. Although it was clearly meant for a caretaker to interpret, and obviously something greater than we know is going on in the archipelago."
"The children," came a small voice. "Someone's taking all the children."
It was Laura Glue. Bert knelt down in front of her.
"What do you mean, darling girl? Is that why your grandfather sent you here?"
She nodded, and a single tear fell down her cheek.
"Grandfather knew. He knew. He saw them coming in the big boats and knew what was going to happen. So he made me put on Uncle Daedalus's wings, gave me the flower, and sent me to find Jamie. He said he would know what to do."
"Who was coming, Laura Glue?" asked John. "Who was your grandfather protecting you from?"
"The men with the clocks in their bellies," replied Laura Glue,
beginning to sob openly.
"Shush, shush. There, there," Bert told her gently. "It will be all right, my girl. But tell me, these men, how did you know they had clocks in their bellies?"
"'Cause you could hear it," she said. "When they was coming to get us, you could hear the sound, tick-tock, tick-tock, over and over and over. And they makes noises when they moves, like a principal."
"Like a car, you mean?"
asked Charles.
"I don't know what that is," said Laura Glue. "But Grandfather called them the clockmen, so..."
"Clockwork men,"
said Bert.
This grows worse and worse. They've been outlawed in the archipelago for nearly a decade.
You mentioned that you were already headed to see me because of a crisis in the archipelago, said John. That's not mere coincidence, is it?
No, I'm afraid it isn't, Bert said somberly. A great catastrophe has befallen the archipelago.
Is Avon all right? Jack asked quickly, recalling his recent dreams. Has she, the Queen, been hurt?
You're three steps ahead of me, young Jack, answered Bert. She's fine, mostly, but she's smack in the center of the crisis. Crises. One of the crises, anyway.
Just how many, crises are we dealing with, Bert?
Charles asked.
All in one, and one in all, it seems, said Bert. And what the child has just told me only confirms my worst fears, that the crisis that began it all, and happened slowly enough that no one knew it was happening until it was over, may not be over after all.
What crisis, Bert? Asked John.
Someone has stolen all the dragon ships, said Bert. They're all gone, and no one knows where.
Gone? Exclaimed John. How can someone have simply taken them? After all, they have wills of their own. I don't think a dragon ship would go anywhere it didn't want to go. Not easily, anyway.
That's part of the mystery, said Bert with a sigh. There are no signs of struggle or damage or even cut anchor lines. The ships have simply disappeared. We think the green dragon went first, then the violet, but there's no way to really be sure. It didn't take much longer to confirm the others. The orange, yellow, and blue dragons were also gone. Even the white dragon is missing.
And the black dragon?
Queried Charles.
What of it?
Audomars dismantled that beast long ago, Bert said with a shudder. And good riddance, I say.
Why was the indigo dragon spared? Asked Jack.
She'd been completely rebuilt as an airship, Bert replied. I think she was either just overlooked, or she no longer suited the thief's purposes.
You haven't said how Avon is involved, noted Jack.
That's how we began to discover the missing children, said Bert. The prince, Avon's son, was aboard the Yellow Dragon when it disappeared. In fact, every place a dragon ship has vanished, many of the local children have disappeared as well.
Avon has a son, said Jack, casting a glance at Jamie. I didn't know.
A strapping lad. Almost 9 years old now, said Bert. I was already preparing to come and seek you out regarding the missing dragon ships when she and Artis contacted me and told me about the prince.
He turned and took John by the shoulders.
I know this is very sudden, John, but we need the caretaker's help. I don't think we can discover the answers we need to find here. We must go back to the archipelago.
Of course I'll help, said John, of course. I'm coming too, put in Jack. Charles, are you with us?
My poor wife will never understand, Charles answered, but I am loath to let the two of you go traipsing off to the archipelago without any adult supervision at all.
I beg your pardon, Bert huffed.
No offence, Bert,
Charles reassured him.
I can send messages to your families, offered Jamie. I'll give them an excuse about emergency business for the university.
Thereby ensuring that we return to find ourselves in hotter water than when we left, said John. Best making it attending to a friend in need. That's closer to the truth anyway.
Excellent, said Bert. We have a plan. Let us now put it into action.
John and Charles quickly wrote out messages to their wives and children for Jamie to pass along, and Jack wrote a brief note to Warney and one to his friend Paddy's mother, a Mrs. Moore. It was also decided that, given the unusual circumstances in the archipelago, Laura Glue would be safer remaining in London under Jamie's care. In fact, once the decision was made, she immediately set about building herself a nest in the storage room upstairs, inside the great wardrobe. Being able to close the doors made her feel safe, she explained, as if no one would be able to reach her there. And safe you will be, Jack said gently, tucking her in amidst the furs and the blankets Jamie had provided. He also had a small electric torch,
which he gave her in case she should become frightened during the night.
Now, he told her, I want you to listen to me. This isn't just an ordinary wardrobe. It's a magic wardrobe.
Laura Glue's eyes widened, and she gave him a lopsided grin.
For really and truly?
For really and truly, Jack nodded. She looked at Jamie, who also nodded.
More than anyone knows, my dear girl.
And if you need it to be, added Jack, it can become another world altogether. It can take you wherever you want to go, for as long as you want, and in an instant it can bring you back as if no time had passed at all.
Wow, said the girl with a yawn. How do I make it work, Jack?
That's easy, Jack told her. Just close your eyes and dream where you want to go, and suddenly you're there.
But I'll do that anyway,
Laura Glue said, leaning back and closing her eyes.
Yes, Jack replied as he closed the door, all but a crack on the drowsing girl. But here you'll always come home, and here someone will be watching over you. Always.
All ready, Jack? Said John.
Ready. Are we all loaded?
Just done, called Charles from the window. Jamie's given us a few stores from his larder, and Bert is anxious to get back to start looking into this. Although, he added, I think he's greatly relieved that we're coming with.
Was there any doubt? Said John. Even under these circumstances, now that the opportunity's here, I find I can't wait to get back.
Same here, agreed Jack.
Bert's face, upside down, appeared in the window.
All aboard, lads. It's time to go.
Farewells were said to Jamie, and each of them looked in quietly on the angel sleeping soundly in the wardrobe. Of them all, only Jack had noticed that before she fell asleep, Laura Glue had carefully sealed her ears with plugs of beeswax she had had tucked in her tunic. With Jamie steadying the rope ladder from below, the companions ascended it and climbed into the carriage of the reborn Indigo Dragon.
It sounds like she's purring, Charles exclaimed.
That's the engine driving the props, said John, looking around in awe. I do kind of miss the old masts and sails, though.
Magic lets you skip a lot of steps, Bert said, but that doesn't mean one can completely disregard principles of engineering. Ladder up? Good, good, he continued. Let's be off, then.
Remember, Jamie called from the window below, to get there, just look for the second star on the right.
That's not funny, Bert replied. Farewell, James.
And you, Bert, Jamie called back, waving. Tell your daughter I hope she will not think too ill of me in the future.
With a final wave, Bert spun the wheel, and the Indigo Dragon whirled about and began to rise into the night air. Below them, the lights of London spread out like glittering pebbles in a dark pool. Everything was edged in a cool light from the rich moon hanging above, and in the distance, clouds had begun to gather. In moments they would be passing into another world. Somehow, it seemed less eventful to be doing it in the air instead of on the more physical surface of the water below.
That last joke Jamie made, John said to Bert, he was quoting his book, wasn't he?
Book? Said Bert, puzzled. Was that in the book? No, he shook his head. It's an old game he played with Laura Glue's grandfather when they were young and could still bear each other's company. In the archipelago, navigating by the second star to the right, the North Star, makes you sail in a circle. You never get anywhere except where you already are.
Who is Laura Glue's grandfather, anyway? Asked Charles.
Bert looked at them all in surprise as the clouds began to close about the ship.
Didn't Jamie tell you?
He probably figured that as caretakers, you already knew.
I think I do, said John, but it seems impossible to believe.
We're into the rarefied air of the archipelago now,
Bert informed the others, gesturing to the waters below and back to the now vanished lights of London.
It's required to believe 16 impossible things before breakfast.
Who are we talking about, John? Asked Jack.
Charles pieced it together first.
There's a statue of him in Kensington Gardens, he said quietly. Am I right, John?
John nodded and leaned over the railing, face to the wind. Laura Glue's grandfather, he explained, Sir James Barry's best friend, who became his greatest enemy, was the boy who never grew up. We've been summoned to the archipelago by Peter Pan. Part 2. A History Undone. Chapter 5. The Errant Knight. The crossing into the archipelago was as smooth and uneventful as they'd remembered. One moment they were above the waters of the world, and the next moment they were not. And in the transition, the English night gave way to a crisp morning light. The crew were many of the same cloven-hoofed fauns that had operated the ship when it sailed on water, although this time the companions were far less hesitant to interact with them.
"Excellent ship you've got here," Charles said to a passing crewman. "Lovely decks."
"Humph," replied the fawn, shoving past.
"Nice chatting with you," said Charles.
"I returned the White Dragon to Ordo Mas, then set about salvaging the wreckage of the old girl,"
Bert said, patting the hull.
"It took us a long time to decide how to proceed, but fortunately we had lots of support and funding from Parallon. Artus and Avon have ruled very well, if, unconventionally, and are widely loved."
"That's good to hear," John said, noting how quickly Jack moved away at the mention of Avon's name. "I'm going to have a hard time calling the High King Artus, though."
"Oh, he insists that his personal friends still call him Bug," said Bert. "Says it helps him keep the common touch. Although, between you and me, I think he just misses the adventures we had before all this running a kingdom business got dropped on him."
"What was Samarenth's opinion on all of this?" John asked. "I assume he was consulted."
"First among the royal advisers," said Bert. "Even more so than I. Since the war with the Winter King, the dragons have never been far from the archipelago. At times they have intervened in certain affairs, but nothing that ever dictated a formal summoning from the ring on Terminus."
The companions looked at one another with somber expressions. A formal summoning could only be done by the High King using the Ring of Power, the great circle of stones they had discovered in the conflict with the Winter King. It was an action Artus would take in only the gravest circumstances. "Until now?" John guessed. Bert nodded.
"At Samarenth's suggestion, every dragon alive has scoured the islands, but has found no sign of the missing ships or children. As far as we can determine, they are nowhere in the archipelago."
"Could they be in our world?"
"Not likely. They would stand out more, not less. Look at the complications you had with just one little girl."
"Jamie told us that he remembered an old archipelago legend about a crusade," said John. "Do you know of such a story?"
"It does sound familiar, I'll admit," said Bert. "But I can't put my finger on it. I'm hoping we may be able to ask the Morgaine what it refers to, and get right to the heart of it."
"You could do that without us," John pointed out. "And with all these things happening in the archipelago, I must admit I don't see how we can help. We came because you asked us to come. But what good are the caretakers going to be in finding missing ships and kidnapped children?"
"Maybe more than you know, John. You are here because you are supposed to be here, and you are the caretakers after all. You well know that the responsibility is far greater than just looking after a book. Even if you are not the caretakers, you are still friends of the King and Queen, and it is in times of peril that one must call on one's friends, wherever and whoever they may be."
"Even if they are enemies, according to Laura Glue."
"Yes," Bert said, "even if they are enemies."
"I can see the smoke coming out of your ears," Charles said, sitting on the deck next to Jack. "What are you considering so mightily?"
"Something I've been thinking about for 9 years," replied Jack. "When we were trying to keep the Winter King from getting his hands on the Geographica."
"Yes," said John, coming to sit opposite Charles.
"The first plan was to try destroying it, right?"
"Correct."
"But we couldn't, because only the cartographer could destroy the book."
"Right again," said John.
"What are you driving at, Jack?"
"Stay with me here," urged Jack.
"Part of the caretaker's job is to annotate maps, add new maps, and also to improve the translations attached to existing maps, right?" Yes, John said, although I haven't yet had the opportunity to add any maps, only make corrections and notations to the existing ones. What of it?
I'm afraid I don't see it either, said Charles.
What he's asking, Bert said without turning from the wheel, is why you didn't simply vandalize the atlas, or scumble in false notations, or simply pour ink all over the pages, effectively destroying its usefulness, if not the book itself.
Well, yes, said Jack, that's exactly what I was wondering. Bert turned his head and squinted at them.
Don't you think that hadn't occurred to me, or Jules, or Stellan, long before you were ever recruited as caretakers?
Then why didn't you do it? Asked John.
Would you have been able to?
Bert shot back. We tried, said Jack. We threw it on the brazier.
No, said Bert. Nemo threw it on the brazier. And when he'd proven it wouldn't burn, that was the end of any thoughts you had of destroying or even damaging the book.
He's right, Charles said. We never even considered it after that.
Clever, noted John. We'd eliminated the idea in principle, so we overlooked other specific aspects of it that may have solved the problem. Would have solved the problem, Jack corrected. We could have solved a major problem with a relatively minor sacrifice.
Jules and I had a similar discussion once, said Bert. He offered me a hypothetical situation. What if a young man, say, a painter from Austria, seemingly normal, absolutely unremarkable, was destined to one day become a terrible ruler, responsible for the death of millions? If, knowing this future, and knowing what might be averted if this single, then innocent artist were to be killed, would you do it?
There's no way to know a man's future, observed John, not for certain, so it would be murder. Jamie told me Nemo was foretold of his death, said Jack, and he did nothing to change that event. So is that a reverse murder? Or a self-murder?
That decision was Nemo's to make for himself, said Bert. It wasn't someone deciding his future for him. But answer the question. Would you kill the painter who had done no evil to save the millions from the evil that he might one day become?
No, John and Jack answered together.
I don't know, Charles admitted. Maybe if it were real and not hypothetical, I could make that choice.
Well, in a way, that was the choice you were making with the Geographica, said Bert. A little murder, with pen and ink as the instruments of the death, and you could prevent the book from being used in greater evil. But that wasn't the choice you wanted to make, so you didn't.
That's all well and good, Jack said, but it still irritates me to no end that the option didn't at least occur to us. Maybe all we needed to alter were a few key maps, or the summoning.
Say,
he said, tapping John's foot, why don't we give it a try? Just for the sake of scientific experimentation. We can pick a minor map and ink in a no trespassing sign, or a unicorn or some such. What do you say, John?
Bert groaned and slapped his forehead.
Spinning in his grave. I'm certain Stellan is just spinning in his grave. I'd have been better off leaving the book with Harry and Arthur.
However irritated he tried to sound, Bert also produced a quill and a bottle of ink, which he proffered to Charles with a barely disguised grin.
Okay, John, said Charles. Let's have it. Time to deface a little history.
Now, I'm not going to just, John began, before a strange expression came over his face. Jack looked from Charles to John and back again, shrugging.
Where did you put it when you brought it aboard?
Bert asked over his shoulder.
In the cabin, perhaps?
You did bring it aboard, didn't you, John? Said Jack.
Oh, dear,
murmured Charles.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
The Imaginarium Geographica, John said with rising horror. It's...
Don't tell me you've lost it, said Bert.
Nothing of the sort, John stated. I know precisely where it is. Jack and Charles looked at each other in disbelief as the meaning of John's words sank in. The Imaginarium Geographica was exactly where they had left it when they arrived in London, next to Laura Glue's wings, safely covered with academic papers, in the boot of John's car. John spent the remainder of the short voyage to Avalon pacing the foredeck and cursing to himself in Anglo-Saxon.
The crew of fauns exchanged glances of different dance, same song, and kept working to keep the ship in order. Bert, Jack, and Charles huddled around the wheel to discuss this awkward turn of events.
"Can we go back for it?" asked Jack.
"We'll have lost only a few hours."
"Hours I'm afraid we cannot spare," said Bert. "Remember, the Indigo Dragon is, for the time being, the only dragon ship available to the Silver Throne, and the only ship left that is able to cross the frontier. Inconvenient as it may be, we will have to do without the original Geographica, and hope that no circumstance arises in which it is needed."
"Original Geographica?" Charles exclaimed. "I don't understand."
Bert grinned.
"Do you recall your little friend, Tumala? He was as good as his word. He published a facsimile edition of the Imaginarium Geographica, and practically everyone in the archipelago has a copy now. It's nowhere near as complete as the original, of course," he continued, "but it's annotated in English and shows all the major islands. It would do in a pinch."
"Good old Tumala," said Charles. "I've often thought of him, usually during breakfast. Never looked at a muffin in the same way since, I can tell you."
John finally quit pacing and approached the others. "There was a lot going on, you remember," he said apologetically, "in all the confusion and commotion."
"Five ham sandwiches," stated Jack. "That's all I'm going to say about confusion and commotion, and no time to retrieve the Geographica."
"The caretaker bloody Principia."
"All right, Jack," Charles said quickly. "No need for language."
"Avalon Ho," said Bert, pointing. "We're at the boundary. Let's get off here and collect ourselves, and then we'll decide what to do next."
Once the ship had been anchored to a spot on the sloping hill above the beach, the companions climbed down and took deep breaths of the sea air.
"Very nice," said Charles. "Makes me feel like I was young again. Not that I feel particularly old, mind you, but this adventuring business is much more a young man's game."
"You called?" Jack said, grinning.
"You're a college tutor," Charles told him. "That means you age exponentially with each semester."
"How about him, then?" Jack said, hooking a thumb at John. "He's a full professor."
"Dog years," said Bert. "Professors age in dog years."
"And how about you, old hat?" asked Charles.
"Oh, I took the easy way out," said Bert. "I figured out that if I age all the way to the end, I just start over. So, practically speaking, I'm the youngest one here."
The first order of business was to announce themselves to the Guardian of Avalon, the Green Knight.
"I shouldn't mind seeing the dutiful old fellow again," Charles said jovially. "He was very affable, after he quit trying to behead us, that is."
"There's something you really ought to know," Bert began,
when they crested the hill and stood in front of the entrance to the ruins of Avalon. There, slumped against one of the fallen pilasters, arms akimbo, the Green Knight turned his head and regarded them with a resigned expression. He seemed younger than before, but was still a mishmash of rusty armour, wooden limbs, and twigs that seemingly stuck out of every joint and crevice. But oddly, he also affected a tattered top hat and trench coat over his armour. It occurred to John that this apparition might be what would result if the Tin Woodsman and Scarecrow from Frank Baum's Oz were squeezed together. The armoured Scarecrow was chewing something, his mossy beard swaying with the motion. Then he swallowed hard and spoke.
"I hope you're not expecting me to stand on ceremony. I may have to stand guard over this junk pile and help you when asked, and all the other shabby things they make me do here. But if you're hoping for some sort of formal welcome, you can forget it."
Charles groaned and rubbed his temples.
"What?" said Jack. "Wasn't he Charles Darnay before?"
"Before, but not now," said Charles,
and with the sound of his voice, the Green Knight recognized him.
"Hey," he exclaimed, standing straighter now. "You're not going to let him hit me, are you?"
John sighed. Now he knew who this was. "That's what Bert was trying to tell us," he said to the others. "This Green Knight isn't the one we met before." It was Magwitch.
I thought the dragons had eaten you, or at the very least dismembered you, maggot, said Charles.
I'm a knight now, Magwitch sniffed, so you have to treat me with more respect.
If you're a knight, I'm Geoffrey Chaucer, retorted Charles.
He turned to Bert, sputtering in anger and amazement.
Magwitch, the Green Knight? How did this happen, Bert?
I wanted to explain, Bert said sheepishly. This is law, part of the old code established by King Arthur centuries ago. The dragon saw it as a fitting punishment for a traitor like Magwitch.
Punishment? Jack exclaimed. He looks as if he's on holiday.
I know, said Bert. It isn't supposed to be an honour. It's supposed to be a penance. But Magwitch is the only knight in more than 2 dozen generations of them who actually rose in station because of it.
Well, I'm not about to trust anything he says, Charles stated.
See? Now you've gone and hurt my feelings, said Magwitch. Just because I'm a murdering, thieving, cowardly, traitorous sort, doesn't mean I can't do my job properly.
Oh, for heaven's sake, said Charles. Fine, whatever you say, just keep him away from me.
With a gesture, the Green Knight motioned for them to follow. John walked beside him, with Jack, Charles, and Bert trailing along a short distance behind. So, said John, what's it like to be made of wood?
Not as bad as you'd think, replied Magwitch. Although you wouldn't believe the places termites can get to.
Sorry I asked, said John. The familiar path wound around the edge of the island, the grasses and craggy rocks standing out in sharp relief against the dark, roiling clouds of the frontier beyond, the true boundary of the archipelago. At the path's end, they would find the Morgaine, the witches known as the Three Who Are One. Sometimes they were able to prophesy the future. Other times they were unwilling to try. Still, Bert explained, it was worth asking, as the Morgaine were likely to be the only entities who could shed any light on the events taking place. Jack suppressed a shudder. I'm really not looking forward to seeing them again, he confided to Charles.
I know what you mean, Charles replied. Those strange old women, especially the one... What was her name again?
Cole, Magwitch said over his shoulder. And I can sympathize. I don't come and see them unless I'm compelled, which isn't often.
Didn't she make you rub her feet once, recalled Jack, suppressing a wicked smile. Magwitch groaned.
Why else do you think I stay on the far side of the island?
They came into the small clearing, but there was no one to be seen. The great black cauldron that sat over the usually crackling fire was nestled among cold embers, and there were other cooking implements scattered here and there amidst the sharp grass. At the far side were 3 tumble-down cottages in a state of extreme disrepair, around which were piled a number of artifacts of all shapes and sizes. Both John and Charles noticed, but said nothing about, the large iron kettle with the bronze adornments, leather handles, and Greek shield for a lid.
Hey-ho! It looks like no one's home, said Magwitch, spinning around on his heel. Time to go!
Not so fast, maggot.
Charles caught Magwitch by the collar of his breastplate.
You're the Green Knight now. You botch your job, I guarantee you, I'll give a full report, omitting nothing, to Samaranth himself.
Bloody hell, muttered Magwitch. A fellow just can't catch a break with you people.
He pointed down the slope.
You'll probably find them in the cave. That's where they spend most of their time these days.
Excellent,
Charles said, giving the reluctant knight a shove.
Lead the way, Sir Maggot.
Chapter 6 The Weaving. The cave was deeper than the opening would indicate, and although they all, with the exception of Bert, who simply removed his hat, had to stoop to enter, once inside they were able to stand erect without bumping their heads. Rather than growing darker, the cave grew lighter the deeper they went. There, at the back, they saw 3 figures, but it took a moment for them to realize that these were not the figures they had expected to see.
instead of the weathered old women draped in layers of dresses and beads and various charms, waiting to welcome the companions, were three youthful, graceful women of astonishing beauty. The nearest of them wore a dress of shimmering blue and had long, golden hair pulled back into a bun at her neck. She sat at a large spinning wheel, which was idle. A pile of unspun wool was beside her, the topmost fibers of which were pulled together in the threads hanging from the wheel. The second woman had hair like flame, tied in looping ringlets that fell onto a cream-colored dress with elaborate patterns embroidered across the chest. Her arms rested on an enormous loom, which seemed to be as unused as the spinning wheel, wrapped as it was in cobwebs. Hundreds and hundreds of threads grew together in a tangle underneath a giant comb, but she made no effort to unbind them. And the third, near the back of the cave, was raven-haired and wore a blue dress of extraordinary richness. Of the three, only she seemed to be engaged in active work. She was slowly and methodically unraveling the threads of a great tapestry that hung across the entire rear wall of the cave. John couldn't be sure, but it seemed as if the images depicted in the great weaving were in motion. It was too indistinct for his eyes to focus on any portion of it for more than an instant, however. The companions and the three women regarded each other silently, until the quiet was broken by a loud wail, which was coming from the Green Knight.
9 years, whimpered Magwitch. All that time, I've been dealing with those three hags outside, and I never knew these beauties were waiting in the cave.
Quiet, you nit, said Charles. I think these three are the old... I think they're the same women.
Just so, concurred the fair-haired woman, bowing her head.
Are you here for the spindle? The dark-haired woman asked, without looking at them or pausing in her labours. Because if you are, you're too late. We already gave it to that princess. What was her name again? Dawn? Aurora, said the red-haired woman, and you're forgetting the order of things. These young men aren't here for the spindle. They've come to ask us questions, haven't you?
John looked askance at Bert, who nodded almost imperceptibly. Yes, said John, we have.
One each, then, said the first woman. 3 questions asked, 3 answered. A question for Ser Edwin to set the stage. A question for Celedriel to begin the play. And a question for Cull to draw the curtain.
I'll be drawn and quartered, Magwitch moaned. They are the same women, and I've been avoiding them all this time.
He threw up his hands and wailed.
Why is life so unfair?
That is your first question, which I shall answer, said Ser Edwin. That's done it, Charles shouted at the former steward. Out! Out!
He grabbed Magwitch by the shoulders and all but threw him to the front of the cave.
I'll keep him occupied, he called back to his friends. Do what you can with the other 2 questions.
Ser Edwin was already beginning to answer the first question, which, John thought to himself, was not really a terrible question to have asked. It just didn't have much to do with their current situation.
Life is so unfair, Ser Edwin was saying, because it is you whose vision is too small. Mistakes may become opportunities. Accidents may become a chance for redemption. What seems unbalanced in a moment may become level over time, if only the canvas upon which your lives are painted is large enough.
John and Jack looked at each other in puzzlement. It was certainly the answer of a prophetess.
My question is next, said Celedriel. Ask of me what you will, and I shall answer.
John nodded at Jack, indicating that it was his turn. And as uncomfortable as that made him, Jack was somewhat relieved that he wouldn't have to talk to Cull, no matter how beautiful her present form was. He considered his options. His first impulse was to ask about his dreams and Avon's son, but that would be too limited a use of the question. It stood to reason that there were only 2 questions that needed to be asked.
the location of the missing dragon ships, and the location of the missing children. Jack chose the former, expecting, silently hoping, that John mirrored his train of thought and would ask the latter.
"The ships you seek